Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In his previous novel, Richard Clarke wrote about a world in the not-too-distant future where China and the U.S. competed for a dwindling supply of oil. Now, in a new novel, the year is 2012, and advances in science and technology threaten to change the very nature of human existence. Using his expertise in terrorism and cybersecurity, Clarke weaves a tale that shows just how interconnected the world really is and how easy it might be for some to sever those connections. His new book is titled Breakpoint. Richard Clarke joins me in the studio. And as always, you are welcome to join us as well. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Please forgive my voice today. I'm suffering a cold and hope to be through it very soon. Good morning to you, Richard Clarke.
Good morning, Diane. It's great to be here after listening to you all these years.
Thank you so much. You were very clear in the last novel, The Scorpion's Gate, that it was not meant to be predictive. This book, however, is meant to be predictive. Explain.
In this book, I'm trying to look around the corner, trying to see what we'll be dealing with 5 years from now. And the part that I think is predictive is the technology. I spent a fair amount of time looking at the emerging technologies, nanotechnology, computer science, neurology, pharmacology, all sorts of fields that are racing forward. The pace of progress is accelerating. And we're going to, as a result, face some very interesting choices as a society and as a nation 5 to 10 years from now.
Such as?
Well, such as right now our standard is that we will allow genetic engineering to fix mistakes, but we won't allow genetic engineering to create enhancements. So
what do you mean by that?
If you have Tay-Sachs or if you have sickle cell anemia, genetic engineering hopefully will be able to prevent that from happening to your children in the future. But you can't decide, I want my children to have a higher IQ, and therefore I want genetic engineering. Or I don't like the color of my hair, and I want my children to have some other designer children. That's something that we've already said is probably not going to be permissible in the United States. But will that hold when other countries are doing it? Or when wealthy Americans can go offshore to get their designer children. What happens when machines get implanted in humans and give them new capabilities? We already have knees and hips. Many of us are going to have either a knee implant or a hip implant in the foreseeable future. But what happens when those implants can perhaps connect you directly to the Internet? People who are paraplegic today, people who are paralyzed, are beginning to experiment with capabilities whereby their brain waves can move a mouse pad and can type on a computer keyboard. Well, if you can do that, the capability of having a nano implant 10 years from now that will allow you to directly communicate, directly link to a database, perhaps even a database on the Internet, is not that far beyond our imagination. So this raises all of these things coming together in the relatively near future, raises questions about what it means to be human.
Richard Clark, he served as National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism for both President Clinton and George W. Bush. He's chairman of Good Harbor Consulting, and his latest book, a novel, is titled Breakpoint. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Breakpoint is set in 2012. Why?
Because I think that's about as far ahead as we can see. The technology is accelerating at such a rate that changes that would used to take place over the course of 20 years are now taking place over the course of 3 or 4. So I'm using the vehicle of a thriller here. Someone is blowing up our technology. Someone is pushing us back into the 20th century. And our two heroes, Susan Connor and Jimmy Foley, are given the task of trying to find out who is blowing up, who is destroying our technology. Why are they doing it? And can they be stopped before our society is pushed back into the 19th century?
So your book begins with a cyber attack on the U.S. How vulnerable do you think the U.S. is right now to such a cyber attack?
Well, I did a survey both for President Clinton and, again, one for President Bush on how vulnerable we are to cyber attack. And what it turns out is cyber is so much more than email. Cyber is so much more than buying a book at Amazon. Cyber runs the electric power grid. Cyber runs the banking, the stock market, airplanes, trains. Without cyberspace and the computer-controlled networks that are in it, nothing works in our society. And we've gotten rid of all the backups that we used to have in the 1980s. We don't still have typewriters around anymore. We don't still have a system to run the electric power grid that's not computer-controlled. So we are very vulnerable because hackers are getting into these systems every day. Criminal hackers are stealing our identity, and nation states are stealing our secret information.
A key character in Breakpoint is a hacker. Tell us about Sockster.
Sockster is a composite of some real hackers I know, and I should say hacker is probably a misused word. It's come to be an epithet. It's come to be a criminal, someone who breaks the law by hacking their way into your computer. The original meaning of the word was just somebody who could slice and dice computer code, someone who really understood computers. Now we say a hacker is someone who's breaking the law and getting into your computer without permission. Well, the differentiation is that white hat hackers don't break the law. They help the government. And Sockster, who can do marvelous things on the Internet and with cyberspace, is a white hat hacker who finds Jimmy and Susan and befriends them and helps them as they wander through cyberspace trying to figure out who's blowing things up.
And he is helping to find the hackers, the black hat hackers, if you will.
He is, and this actually goes on every day. There are hackers that work for the government and work for private sector companies that are trying to find out where these people are today who are stealing hundreds of millions of dollars through theft and fraud in cyberspace, who are getting into very sensitive files in the government and in companies and stealing that information.
So as someone who has served in such high places in the government, you bring some of that experience to this novel. How afraid should I be?
Well, I think we should all be concerned that cyberspace is vulnerable. I think we should be concerned that the global village that we have built is held together by very fragile strands. And this marvelous 21st century technological society that we have could easily revert to something far more primitive if someone systematically went about going after our vulnerabilities which we're not very well protecting.
Have you, by chance, seen the film Children of men.
I did, and it was very depressing and very frightening because it shows a society in England in the very near future.
2027,
where homeland security has run amok, and security is the dominant thing that the government wants to do, and it has destroyed society.
What happens in that film is that the youngest human being left alive, who is 18 years old, dies. There has not been a child born in the world in 18 years. And that's where I get to your view of transhumanism. Explain that to us.
Well, there is a movement in this country called transhumanism. It's real. And it's not nefarious. It's not a terrorist group. It's a group of people who ask questions like I'm asking in the book, which is, what can we do to improve the human race through machine implants, through genetic engineering? Can the human race take control of its own evolution, which would be a first? No species has ever done that before. Diane, we may, in the lifetime of people now born, children now among us, in their lifetime, the human race may take control of its own evolution. And if it does, where do we want to evolve?
How do we take control of our own evolution?
Well, through a combination of genetic engineering and nanotechnology and other implants, so that in the future, the human body is not just purely natural, it also includes machine implants. And the line between what's a machine and what's a person gets a little blurry. The Army today is developing something called an exoskeleton suit that allows people wearing this suit to have superhuman qualities. They can pick up a car with one arm. They can have telescopic vision through their eyes. The people who brought us the Internet, DARPA, are developing these suits.
Richard Clark, his new novel is titled Breakpoint. He served as National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism in both the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. Stay with us. Many emails, many phone calls. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Obviously, Richard Clark, what you're saying and your new book are of great interest to our listeners. The new novel is titled Breakpoint. Here is an email from Dan in Falls Church. He says, in addition to talking about Mr. Clark's fiction, please ask him to reflect on his 9/11 Commission testimony, where he stated that the president made a terrible worsening of the fight against terrorism by invading Iraq. Does Mr. Clark still stand by this assertion made publicly before a distinguished commission?
Well, when I said that in 2003 that the president had made the war on terrorism more difficult by going into Iraq, very few people agreed with me then. I think a lot of people agree with me now. And I think the argument that the president makes that we have to be in Iraq because of the war on terrorism is backwards. By being in Iraq, we are motivating terrorists. We are giving them a training ground where they can kill Americans. And we are not addressing the real threat to the United States, which is bin Laden and al-Qaeda. We're not reducing our vulnerabilities here at home, doing things like securing the subways and rail cars carrying chemical gases. There's a whole series of things, container shipping, that we should be doing here in our country. But there's no attention to it and there's no money for it because we're doing things in Iraq that are actually causing more terrorists.
I'm going to go back to your book. I'm sure a great many people will have more questions for you on that issue. You talk in the book about the singularity, which is a real theory. Talk about the singularity and how it appears in this book.
Now, the futurist Ray Kurzweil has written a book called The Singularity.
Who was on this program.
And is a character briefly mentioned in the novel. The singularity is a theory that we are going to find a point in the relatively near future where computer science, through artificial intelligence and whatnot, creates machines that can think and machines that can reach out and talk to each other, that in essence there will be life of a kind in computer systems. And it raises the issue, if we are carbon-based life forms as humans, are we creating silicon-based life forms in the form of advanced computer networks? And when we reach that point, what happens? Is there the possibility that the two life forms merge, or is there the possibility that two life forms become enemies?
And that's how you see in the novel the expansion, if you will, of the evolutionary process.
It could very well be that part of our evolutionary process is merging computers and merging electronics with human beings. If you take it out far enough, Kurzweil talks about things like downloading the human brain so that you could have a backup of yourself on a laptop. I know that sounds funny, but a lot of the things that we do today would have sounded funny to people 20 years ago.
Do you think that the advances that we are currently seeing in technology somehow threaten our democracy?
I do, and I'm not against the advances at all, but I think we need to work some things out. It has never been the case that the rich were smarter. The rich like to think they're smarter, but as Bill Clinton constantly pointed out, some of the smartest people throughout history were born in very poor homes. Well, if the rich in the future can pay to have their children smarter, either through genetic engineering or memory enhancement pills, if over generations people are smarter who can afford to be, people can live longer who can afford to be through genetic engineering and pharmacology, then we're no longer going to be a country of equality. We're going to be moving into a caste system, almost the kind of thing that Plato talked about with gold men and silver men, because we will know empirically that some people have capabilities that other people don't have because they can buy them.
Of course, one of the subplots of Breakpoint is the role that China plays on the world stage. How far behind the U.S. is China technologically?
It depends a lot on the technology. They're catching up very fast. We know that the Chinese army has created cyber warfare units to attack an enemy through cyberspace.
What does that mean?
Well, one of their generals has said publicly that in case there ever were a war with the United States, that China would reach out through cyberspace to turn off the American electric power grid, to get to the cyber controls that run our electric grid and shut them off. Now, there's also been some discussion publicly that the United States may have created cyber warfare units for that same sort of purpose. The book is set in 2012, and in it, in Chapter 2, a satellite is destroyed by an ASAT weapon, and the U.S. Air Force thinks it's China. Well, something like that happened just last week.
The day after, this is an email from Helen in Colonial Beach, Virginia, who says, the day after Mr. Clark's new book came out, I heard that China had shot down a satellite with a missile. Richard Clark has replaced Alvin Toffler as number one futurist.
Well, I'm not a futurist, but I try to stay in touch with them so I can reflect that their knowledge in the novels. And China did destroy a satellite in space. In the novel, they do that, or somebody does that, as part of a program to push our technology back, to cut the communications lines that hold us together.
Are you using your knowledge to warn the American people through your novels?
That's exactly what I'm trying to do, to get them to read a thriller, which they will enjoy, but to, at the same time, begin to think about some of the problems that we're going to face 5 years from now. You know, if I ask you to watch a show on PBS Frontline about the threat of nuclear terrorism, most people won't do that. But if they see it on the TV show 24, which apparently has a scenario with a nuclear bomb in a suitcase, well, then millions of people will see it and millions of people will talk about it. So rather than always writing nonfiction and op-eds and things like that, I'm using fiction to tell the truth and get people thinking, but to do it in a way that they will enjoy reading it and that people who wouldn't read nonfiction might read.
Why did you leave the Bush administration?
Diane, it was very clear to me at the time that the Bush administration was going to go to war with Iraq. And it was very clear to me at the time that that was an enormous mistake. I didn't think I could be any part of that. I was very, very frustrated with what I thought was their lying about the relationship between al-Qaeda, which I knew a great deal about, and Iraq. And I told them that there was no relationship between 9/11 and Iraq.
You say you told them, whom did you tell?
I told the president, I told the vice president, I told the national security advisor, I told everybody who would listen. There was no relationship between Iraq and 9/11.
Why do you believe they went ahead?
I think many people in high places in this administration, before they even came into office, intended to go to war with Iraq. And they looked for excuses once they came into office. There were a whole series of diverse motivations depending upon the individual. Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Cheney all have their own motivations. The president has his in some different combination probably with every person. But they intended to do this. The president didn't campaign saying, elect me and we'll invade Iraq. But I think most of the people around him intended that all along.
Do you believe that the same motivation is at work with regard to Iran?
I hope not. I have spent a long time looking at how a war with Iran would play out. Very easy to begin. The United States can bomb things in Iran with impunity. But what happens the next day? Iran has lots of terrorist organizations that it controls, from the Al-Quds force to Hezbollah. They can attack us not only in Afghanistan and Iraq and throughout the Persian Gulf, but they can attack us here in the United States. Then, Diane, what do? We attack them, they attack us. What's the next move? Where does it end? And I have never been able to find an end to that scenario that's in U.S. interest.
There have been some rumors that Israel plans a bomb, to bomb Iran, which would then almost automatically bring in the U.S. if Iran then turns around and hits Israel.
Someone planted a story in a London newspaper 2 weeks ago that Israel was planning nuclear weapon strikes against the Iranian nuclear facilities. I think that's part of a mind game that someone is playing on the Iranians. I can't believe that Israel would use its ultimate weapon in a preemptoral way to attack Iran when Iran hadn't attacked Israel in any way.
Who do you think would have planted that story and why?
Well, I think if you're trying to manipulate the Iranian leadership in their decision-making process, because they're not monolithic. In fact, the president, Ahmadinejad, has recently been instructed to get out of the nuclear issue. So there's a group of people making decisions there, and I think the United States sends an aircraft carrier battle group out there. It starts arresting Iranian officers in Iraq. It starts saber-rattling here and there. Somebody is causing problems inside Iran, in their Arab community, and in their Azeri community. I think it's entirely possible that the United States or the United Kingdom might be trying to manipulate the Iranian leadership's thinking about what they want to do with their nuclear program.
How secure do you think Ahmadinejad is in his position now?
Well, I think he's not going to be kicked out of his position, but I think it's entirely possible that the leadership group will cut back on his responsibility. And I think it was absolutely unprecedented, what we saw recently, where people said his role in the nuclear weapons decision process, the development of their nuclear program, was being cut back. That's a good thing.
Do you think that that whole volatility of commentary on his part might subside as a result?
I think he was very much trying to whip up a problem with the United States to unite the country behind him, because it's not united behind him at all. People are upset by the social controls in the country. They're upset by some of the economic difficulties in the country, dislocations, even though the price of oil had helped them last year. Now with the price of oil down at $50 a barrel, down from 77 last year, Iran's income is falling precipitously.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First, let's go to Carmel, Indiana. Good morning, Daryl. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I hope you get to feeling better soon.
Thank you so much.
And Mr. Clark, thanks for being available to us. I had a question. I actually had two questions. They seem unrelated. What about Russia and their relationship with Iran and Syria? And as they move forward with both the nuclear developments and then they're selling arms to Iran and Syria as defensive, under the auspices of them being defensive weapons, obviously when they're not. And the other question seems unrelated. But what about the whole idea that scientists are actually creating microscopic black holes in controlled environments where they think they can recreate the situation within which they suppose that the universe was created?
Well, I can answer the first question about the Russian role with Iran and Syria. There's not as much of a role with Syria, but with Iran, the Russians look at Iran as a market. It's a market where they can sell their weapons, and it's a place where they can do business, particularly because they face little competition from the United States since we do not do business there. Russia has that way of looking at a lot of countries. Syria, not so much, because Syria doesn't have oil, Syria doesn't have money. With regard to black holes, I had to do a lot of studying and research to write Breakpoint. And it was mainly in the area of computers and genetics. And thankfully, I didn't try physics.
Thanks for your call, Daryl. I want to take that question about Iran and Syria just a tad farther. There have been some, including the commission that the president established to study Iraq and the war in Iraq, suggesting that the U.S. talked directly with Iran and Syria. What do you believe the outcome would be if the U.S. were to engage in direct talks with those two countries?
Well, I think it would take a long time to get agreement. But Diane, I go back to the Cold War. I started in the government in 1973. My first jobs were sitting across the table from the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union. And I did that for 20 years until the fall of the Soviet Union. We negotiated with the evil empire. It didn't hurt us. We didn't reward the Soviet Union by talking to them. I think we have to talk to Syria. We have to talk to Iran.
And why are we not?
Well, this administration says that it rewards bad behavior to talk to them. Only if you think that talking is a reward. Before the United States invaded Iraq, Syria was somewhat quietly, but nonetheless helpful in the war against al-Qaeda. Syria thought al-Qaeda was a major threat to Syria. And so when I was in the White House, we could reach out to Syria and get their cooperation on going after individual al-Qaeda operations.
So who in the White House is pushing the do not talk attitude?
Well, I think the vice president is very much the spokesman for this do not talk attitude. Maybe let's give them some hope. Let's say maybe behind the scenes they're using back channels to communicate with the Iranians. But there's no real substitute for sitting down in public, in front channels, and negotiating.
Richard Clark, his new novel is titled Breakpoint. I hope you'll join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. Additional support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, committed to creating opportunities for people to live freer, better, and more prosperous lives, online at fordfound.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with ABC legal correspondent Jan Crawford Greenberg about the Rehnquist Court. It's the subject of her new book, Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for control of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. Richard Clark is my guest. He served as National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism for both President Clinton and President George W. Bush. He has turned to fiction writing, certainly incorporating much of what he's learned and what he sees in his new novel, Breakpoint. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Here's an email from Anne, who is at George Mason University. She said, I am also involved in the development of a graduate program in counterterrorism. Does Mr. Clark have any specific recommendations as to how we can better prepare students for 2012?
Well, I teach every other semester at Harvard at the Kennedy School, and I've taught courses on terrorism. And what I find so interesting is that students know about today. They know about what's going on in terrorism today by reading the newspapers. But they don't know the origin of some of the Islamic movements that go back to the 14th century with people like Ibn Taymiyyah. We have to, if we're going to understand the enemy, bin Laden, al-Qaeda, we have to understand their frame of reference, their cultural frame of reference, their historical frame of reference, their motivations, and see the world through their eyes. I tried to do a little bit of that in the novel Scorpion's Gate. I think it's important for us not just to teach students about the current terrorist groups and their tactics, but to go back to the origins that bin Laden and others have read.
The president is likely to talk about Iraq tonight and the war on terror in his State of the Union address. What is your opinion regarding his new way forward and his increase of troops, U.S. troops going to Iraq?
Well, Diane, it's very disappointing because I don't think it will do any good. I don't think it will change things in Iraq. I think that the presence of U.S. forces actually contributes to the problem there. We have to get back to our primary national security interest, the U.S. interest, and that is to prevent terrorists from operating sanctuaries where from which they can attack the United States. We don't need to have major combat troops in Iraq to do that. We can do that with intelligence operations and special forces and paying other Iraqis to do the work for us and even conducting airstrikes if necessary. But I think all Bush has done by this buildup, this escalation, is to delay the day when we start to pull out. And the effect will be the same, whether it's 2 years from now or 4 years from now. When we pull out, there will be a certain amount of chaos. And the difference that these 20,000 troops are going to make in that level of chaos when we pull out is negligible, if there's any difference at all. So all we're doing is putting more troops over there, having more Americans killed and wounded. We have 2,000 double amputees, as well as our 3,000 dead. And we're pushing off the decision to come out of Iraq into the next administration.
If you were making that decision yourself or advising this president about how soon to get out, what would your advice be?
I would say have some personal courage. Don't put it off into the next administration to make that decision. You got us in there. It was a mistake. It's not working. It's going from bad to worse. Let's start over the course of the next 12 months, as the Baker-Hamilton Committee said, and let's start pulling out our major combat units. Don't abandon Iraq. Don't let it become a terrorist haven. But pull out our major combat units and begin that now.
All right. Let's go now to Tempe, Arizona. Good morning, Ram. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane Reams. Thank you for taking my call.
And
I always enjoyed your
Ram, you know, your telephone is breaking up on us. I'm not sure we're going to be able to hear your...
Let me try to be loud. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I just had a quick question about the implantable devices that your guest pointed out initially in his novel. I'm a scientist working on energy area, and one of the questions that I have is a lot of these devices take up a huge amount of power. And if you look at how the technology is going towards energy and power, it's not going to be anything that's foreseeable in the next 5 years that you have something implantable that's going to take energy from your body and use it up for these devices.
Richard Clark.
Well, I think power is a big problem. What we've seen today so far is that some people with mental disorders are benefited by having a microfiber wire into their brain that gives them periodic electrical charges. And to provide the energy source for those electrical charges, battery packs are placed inside the collarbone. And so people with acute depression are being helped by little microelectrical charges that run from a power pack in the collarbone through a fiber optic cable up into the brain and stimulates and overcomes the depression. So that's our first attempt at having a power source, a battery pack behind the collarbone. But as technology evolves, I'm sure these problems will be solved.
Do you therefore believe that ultimately implantations of some sort could be used to control thinking?
Well, I would hope we would never go there. I would hope that the implants empower us and make us more capable and also overcome problems like depression and other genetic deficiencies.
Here's an email from Diane in New Hampshire. Please comment on the foot-dragging on the part of the administration with regard to the overdue NIE on Iraq, the National Intelligence Estimate.
Diane, when I was in the intelligence business, I spent a lot of time helping draft and coordinate national intelligence estimates. They're a great vehicle. All the U.S. intelligence agencies, and there are over a dozen, get together, and together they put all the facts on the table and all the questions, and they do an analysis together, and sometimes there's disagreement. It's meant to inform big decisions. So you get an NIE, a national intelligence estimate, done and delivered to the president before he makes a big decision. In this case, it's backwards. The president has made his decision on Iraq without the benefit of the national intelligence estimate.
Why is it so overdue?
Well, I understand that there has been deadlines have been allowed to slip.
Why?
Well, if I were in the White House and I wanted something to be done on time, I would make sure deadlines were met. And if I were in the White House and didn't really want to get some bad news, perhaps I would have my friends in the agencies let those deadlines slip.
What would the bad news likely be in this most recent overdue NIE?
I think if the NIE is truthful, it will say that situation in Iraq has gone from bad to worse, that all of the likely outcomes are bad, that there is no good way out, that we only have choices among bad options, and that adding U.S. troops of the number we're adding, 20,000, for a short period of a couple of years, will not change the outcome. That the only way that we could really change the outcome would be to put in 100,000 or more troops in addition and be willing to stay there for 7 to 10 years. That's what the history of counterinsurgency shows us.
So you believe that that NIE has been deliberately postponed?
I wouldn't have said that 5 or 6 years ago, but the history of the Bush administration leads me to believe that they tried to manipulate intelligence.
And therefore have not wanted to see the news from the NIE.
The National Intelligence Estimate would also go to the intelligence committees on the Congress at the same time as they, or shortly after it went to the president. So I don't think the president wanted to see Democrats and even Republicans who oppose him now standing up in Congress waving the NIE, saying, you can't make this decision to send additional troops to Iraq because it doesn't make sense.
Yesterday, John Warner, a senator from Virginia and a staunch Republican supporter of the president, came out and said he would not be in support of the president's way forward in Iraq. What does his lack of support mean for the president's policy?
And Diane, it was a bombshell in Washington yesterday. This man is steeped in defense studies. He was the former Secretary of the Navy. Until recently, he was the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He is known as a man of great principle who has stood up against politics when issues arose, conflicts between politics and principle. When John Warner, an expert in this field and a longtime Republican, says the president is wrong, it's going to be very, very difficult for the president to get Congress behind him on
but
this.
But he's already started sending additional troops.
Yes, and he can. And he can send additional troops until the Congress goes beyond simply saying it disagrees and starts passing laws that put a cap on the number of troops. And many of these resolutions that people like Senator Warner and others are introducing merely say, we disapprove. They don't do anything. There are some amendments being offered by Senator Kennedy and Senator Clinton and others that actually will put a cap on the number of troops in Iraq, and that will make a big difference.
Let's go now to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Jack. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Clark, you're clearly a very intelligent person, and it's an honor to speak with you. You've thought a lot about adversaries and planning for adversaries that the U.S. has in the world. And my question is, do you think that the human species is really almost just hardwired to see things in terms of enemies? Or do you think there may be some hope that for somehow that so much of our resources that in the world, but especially the United States, are turned towards military activity, that somehow that some of those resources could be turned towards what people, the average person, says they really want, but our politicians across the board are unable to deliver, which is peace. And there's a concept called the Department of Peace, which I suspect a lot of people in Washington think is laughable. But do you think that there is any hope to deliver that kind of future for people, or are we just doomed to see things in terms of enemies?
Well, I think you put your finger on it, that we're spending an awful lot of money on defense. And I've spent my adult life worrying about defending the United States. But I have to say, we're spending way too much money on the Defense Department and the intelligence community. Not only are we spending these huge amounts, $500 billion on Iraq, but putting that money aside, the defense budget has increased steadily under President Bush, even without regard for Iraq. And there's not much room for anything else as a result. And we're buying things that seem to be designed to fight the Cold War. We just announced there's going to be a new aircraft carrier named after President Ford. Well, why do we need 12 aircraft carriers when nobody else has any?
Good question. At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Number of our emailers would like to know whether any of the announced or unannounced presidential candidates has approached you for advice?
No, they haven't. People keep saying, well, you're just doing all this writing so that you can get a job in the next administration. And I served 30 years in national security positions. I'm never going to serve another day in one. I've done
it. You don't want to go back, no matter who's in the White House.
No matter who's in.
Why?
Well, because I think one only has about 50 years of working life. And if you spend 30 years, as I did, doing one thing, that's probably too much. Life is too short not to do other things. And I'm enjoying writing. I'm enjoying teaching. I'm enjoying consulting. It's sort of a second life for me. And I don't want to go back and do what I did for 30 years. There are younger people who have more energy. And believe me, those jobs in the White House are killer. And you need to have that energy. I don't think I need to go back.
We'll take one last call. This one from Flint, Michigan. Good morning, Reginald. You're on the air. Very quickly, please.
Yes, I was wondering: is this war really in America's interest, or is American interest really a cover for corporate America interest?
Well, I don't buy the theory that we did this war to help corporations, although it is helping some corporations. It's also hurting others. No, this war is clearly not in America's interest. It has reduced our support around the world to an all-time low, and it has encouraged terrorists.
How long do you think we'll be in Iraq?
It depends upon how quickly the next president wants to get us out.
So you believe it is going into the next presidential?
I think George Bush doesn't have the guts to make the decision on his watch to get out of Iraq. I don't think he can admit that it's a mistake, and I don't think he can preside over what will undoubtedly be a very, very messy situation when we get out.
And so you believe he'd rather leave it to the Democrats?
Or to whoever the next president is. He is pushing the responsibility of cleaning this mess up onto the next president.
Do you believe that the next president is going to be a Democrat?
I don't know. This is a fascinating election so far. Saturday, I think we were 2 years away from the inauguration, and already we have 8 Democrats and almost as many Republicans running. It's the first time since 1952, I'm told, when I was 2 years old, that a president is not running for re-election or a vice president is not running. In other words, it's the most open race since I was 2 years old.
And you're very much interested in following it, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm a Washington political junkie.
Richard Clark, he served as National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism for both President Clinton and George W. Bush. His new novel is titled Breakpoint. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Andersman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts.